everyone to this session, which is on cuts, crisis and capitalism. And we've got four people who are going to be kicking off this discussion, and then we'll open it up. So if we can just listen to what the speakers have got to say to begin with, and then if we can just speak using hands and I'll facilitate that discussion. And if I can't see you because you're too far in the dark, then jump up and down. Okay, so just to introduce everybody, we're going to start off with John, who's going to set the scene in terms of where we're at with global capitalism. Graham is then going to talk about tax havens and the response of UK Uncut. Jenny is going to be talking about how certain communities have been scapegoated and linking up struggles. And Chris is going to be talking about current responses on the left and whether indeed capitalism is in crisis.
Okay. Nice to see you all. At least I can't quite see everybody at the back there, but anyway. Okay, so 10 minutes is what I've been given. I'll try not to run on, but it's not very much time to try and capture this incredibly complex, fast-moving and gigantic global economic crisis that is now, it's now in its fourth year. It's very interesting. When did it all break out? Right? The actual moment when global capitalism suffered its first of a series of heart attacks was actually by coincidence on Nagasaki Day, August the 8th, 2007. First of all, in the morning, European banks stopped lending to each other because they didn't know who had the subprime loans, the skeletons in the cupboard. They didn't know where the corpses were buried, as they say. So they stopped, they lost confidence in each other and weren't lending money to each other. And so the European Central Bank had to inject a whole load of money. A few hours later, the US market opened because they're a couple of hours behind us. And the same thing happened in the United States. And that really marked the very beginning. And I think that's really significant because, really, if you could say there was one date in the last century which really marked, you know, one date that marked the end of World War II and the beginning of the post-world order, the beginning of the Pax America, as it used to be called, was really Nagasaki Day. That was when the war in the East also, I mean, Japan surrendered a day or two later, but really that was the end of World War II. And it's very interesting that what Anne Pettifor of the New Economics Foundation has called the detonation, when the debt bomb exploded, right? It was on Nagasaki Day. So the beginning and the end of the post-World War II order began and ended with a type of a detonation, a nuclear bomb going off over the civilians of Nagasaki, and then the equivalent of a financial nuclear bomb going off with detonation when the debt bomb exploded. And I think what, just to telescope the last couple of years, we have to say that around a year ago, or perhaps a bit longer, you could say this crisis entered a new and much, much more dramatic stage, and that was when you started getting sovereign debt crisis breaking out. Portugal, Ireland, the peripheral countries of Europe, as they call them, suffering from a debt spiral of increasing interest rates on debt, collapsing economy, cuts causing the economy to contract, etc., etc. And also you had something else happening, and that was that every single country was putting forward a policy of trying to escape from the recession by increasing their exports, by increasing their competitiveness. Now, it stands to reason that if one country is going to increase its exports, that means another country has to increase its imports. And no, it's not possible. It's a zero-sum game or even a minus-sum game. So that Obama, for instance, promised that he would, in 5 years, double the size of US manufacturing exports. But who's going to buy this stuff, and how are they going to compete against China? The US companies themselves have been moving production. Anyway, so what this all basically adds up to is that it sets in motion a logic of what was called the currency wars, wars between the different nations. The cooperation breaks down. The cooperation that characterised the first few years of the crisis, where the major powers were actually trying to cooperate with each other to contain this crisis, to stop the global economy from ceasing, that cooperation is now broken down, and each country is trying to carry out policies, each bloc, whatever, to export the effects of the crisis onto others. It's what they used to call in the 1930s beggar thy neighbour policies, right? Competitive devaluation of currencies. to try and increase your own export share by driving out others. And we see this now with the G20 summit taking place, that all these fissures, all these cracks and inter-imperialist rivalries, as I think they should be correctly called, are all breaking out into the surface, making agreements basically impossible. We'll come on to the consequences of that in a minute. So, anyway, there's already quite a few ideas there. I think I've already probably used up at least half of my time. One of the things I want to say about trying to understand the crisis, one of the challenges in it, is that it's so easy to make a big mistake, and that is to regard the sequence of events, the way that things unfold chronologically, to be the same as the cause and effect. So in other words, what happens first isn't necessarily the cause of what then happens. Sometimes the cause of something only appears after the effect. And here is a classic example of this. Because what appears first of all is a crisis in finance, between in the relations between the banks in Europe and the United States. What happens then? It causes a credit crunch. People have less money to spend. Governments cut back spending. So there's less demand for goods. So high street starts suffering. First of all, the factories, first of all, it's the banks, then it moves to the commercial sector, and then as they cut orders, so finally it ends up with industry itself, production, finding it's got less and less customers. But the real sequence of events, so that's what's happening now. The financial crisis breaks out, causes a credit crunch, and now causing contraction in the economy and the threat of a global depression with massive cutting in industry. But the real challenge is to see that the real cause of this crisis is not finance. It is not a financial crisis. It is a crisis of production. It's a crisis of capitalist production. Capitalist production that relies on only one thing, and that is to increase its profit. The way to understand this crisis, and I'll try and finish off on this point, is to see it as the reappearance of the crisis of the 1970s. We had stagflation. That was the first synchronised crisis of the major capitalist economies. And you could say, to be very brief, that the capitalist world managed to escape from that crisis by three things, or you could say four things. First thing was massively increasing debt. By artificially increasing demand, they created demand for all these products so they could sell them and still make a profit on them. Second thing was the fortuitous arrival of internet technology. That if you're going to invest £10 million and a £1 million profit, if you do that in 1 year, you've got 10% rate of profit. If it takes you 2 years to do it, you only get 5% rate of profit. So internet technology helped to compress or speed up the turnover time of capital and increase the rate of profit that way. But there was a third and very important way that they managed to increase the rate of profit, and that was by shifting production to low-wage countries. They needed to radically cut costs in the 70s to escape from their crisis. They couldn't say to steelworkers and miners in Britain and the United States, sorry, we're going to have to cut your wages by 60%. Because they knew there'd be a revolution if they tried to do this. But they were able to achieve equivalent cuts by moving production to low-wage countries. And so it is that in 1980, at the beginning of what you call globalisation, there were as many industrial workers in the industrial countries as in the rest of the world. Now, 80% or more of the world's industrial workers are in China, Bangladesh, Morocco, etc. And more and more and more of the wealth of the rich nations relies on the super profits extracted from super exploited labour in the global south. And so it's very important to see just briefly how that could have possibly affected the crisis. One of the things that helped to create the whole sort of financial explosion, or the whole financial bubble that blew up all these bubbles, was the fact that interest rates remained very, very low in the period leading up to the crisis. That encouraged people to think they could borrow more money, corporations to think they could borrow more money, and governments to think they could borrow more money. Why did interest rates stay so low? One of the reasons was that China was building up huge, and Brazil and other countries building up huge dollar pools from selling all their stuff to us. And the only thing that they can do with this money, for various reasons, but the only thing they can do with this money is to basically lend it back to the rich countries so they can continue to purchase the products of their factories. And so China and other countries built up this huge amount of money, lending it back to the rich countries. And because they were lending money back to the rich countries at a phenomenal rate of billions of dollars, at more than $1 billion a day for about 10 years, if you can imagine that, that meant that interest rates stayed low. But it also meant that the banks and so on in the Western world that were trying to invest money and get a rate of interest, had to find very risky places to put their money to in order to get any kind of a rate of interest, because all interest rates have been depressed. So banks were encouraged to take more and more risk. They had to make more and more risk, or else they wouldn't have made a profit. So the rise in the debt and the increasing risk-taking, all of these things have been blamed as the cause of the crisis, but really they are a symptom or an effect of the outsourcing of production to the global south. And in many other ways, it can be shown that really this is that all that outsourcing production did, all that the increase of debt did, was basically they were like sort of therapies. They were ways of actually relieving the underlying crisis of the 1970s. These therapies have now become pathologies. Debt itself is no longer a cure for the problem. It is the problem. The outsourcing production is no longer a cure. It's creating new problems of its own. So all of the medicines they took that have transformed the world so much in such a mutilated way in the last 30 years were attempts escape from the crisis of the 1970s. Those measures have now blown up in their face or in our faces. They have now become a source of crisis in and of themselves, and the underlying crisis itself no longer has any therapies for it. There is no solution to this crisis. All roads lead into the crisis. Everything, every different policy which has been put forward by every different government, every different economist, all of them in one way or another lead to the same conclusion, and that is we are heading into a gigantic crisis and there is no capitalist way out of this crisis. That's my talk.
Thank you. Okay. Going
to
go straight on to the next.
My name's Graham. I'm here to talk a little bit about tax and tax avoidance. I'll put that in the context of what we just heard about the global south, and also in the realms of today's politicians here in the UK, who talk about there being a deficit and a need to reduce that deficit, there being no alternative, and also the need to sort out the mess that was left by the previous administration. All those are lies. There isn't a real problem in this country with the deficit. The deficit is low here in the UK. It's a fifth of what it was in 1948 when the NHS was set up. This week we've seen the Lords pass the bill to destroy the NHS. And that's another part of this strategy. It's not really got anything to do with economics. In a real sense, it's more to do with helping the corporate interest into one of those pristine organisations that we here in the UK still have, the National Health Service. They don't like that. It's an opportunity for big business to take money from the taxpayer. That's what's going on. But what I'd like to do, really, is just talk a little bit about tax and about what happens in this country in relation to tax, and then just mention something about UK on the foot. And so first of all, what I'd like to do is just take us all back just before the financial crisis of the summer of 2007 and the collapse of organisations like AIG and Lehman Brothers across the States, and the financial crisis that then ensued in the US and over here in Britain and Europe, and just give a few facts and figures about what's been going on here. In 2007, here in the United Kingdom, the Audit Office reported that a third of the UK's biggest companies paid no tax at all in the financial year 2006 to 2007. But that doesn't mean that in the good times, many of our most successful businesses were making no money. Far from it. According to the Treasury's own figures for 2006, there was a tax gap. And what I mean by the word tax gap, it's basically money owed to but not paid to UK Revenue and Customs. So it's tax money owed but not paid. And in 2006, there was a tax gap of somewhere between 90 and 150 billion pounds. That's big money. In that same year, I'm going to talk a little bit about bananas. In that same year, the three biggest banana companies in the world, that's Del Monte, Chiquita and Dole, did over £500 million worth of business here in Britain. But they paid less than £20,000 tax on that £500 million. Now, the average wage in this country is something like £23,000. If four people on the average wage took their tax bill, that would amount to more than £20,000. But these three massive companies can get away with paying less tax than the average employee. That's a shocking figure. And I'm going to be coming back to the banana in a minute or two. Now, what's going on? More than 50% of world trade now passes through what are called tax havens. Over half of all banking assets and a third of all foreign direct investment by multinational corporations are now handled offshore. Over 80 of the USA's biggest 100 corporations have subsidiaries located in tax havens. And these figures are from US Government Accountability Office reports. It's not conspiracy theory that we're talking about. Every figure I use is documented and available. The Tax Justice Network, which I think John mentioned earlier, has found that 99 of Europe's top 100 companies use offshore subsidiaries. And the biggest player in this manoeuvre is the banks. Barclays, Citigroup, the big banks that operate in Wall Street and in the Square Mile in London. They are at the heart of the offshore economy. A man called Nicholas Shackson has researched offshore economies, and he published a book earlier this year, I think, called Treasure Islands. It's well worth reading for anybody who's really interested in what's going on here. And Nicholas Shackson defines a tax haven as a place that seeks to attract business by offering politically stable facilities to help individuals or corporations to get around the rules, the laws, and the regulations of jurisdictions elsewhere. In other words, get around the law of the land here in England, in the States, or in Africa and the developing world. And he goes on to explain that the whole point of the offshore economy is to offer escape routes from the duties that come with living in and obtaining benefits from society. Benefits such as the opportunity to sell commodities and offer services in the markets onshore. And the duties that they avoid through the use of tax havens are such things as tax, but also financial regulation. Corporations don't like regulation. They don't like being held accountable. They also use tax havens to get around such things as criminal and civil law. So this is serious stuff that's going on. Tax havens exist in order to help big businesses and wealthy individuals as well to escape the rules. That is what they do. That's what they're there for. And tax havens are not simply a curious, exotic phenomenon used by Mick Jagger or Elton John. They don't just exist on the margins of the real world. They are the central component of the global economy. And that's an important point to bear in mind. It's important to make sense of what's going on. If we want to know what's happening in Africa or South America, Guatemala, Angola, wherever we look, if we don't understand offshore, we can't really make sense of what's happening globally. And that is a really important point to bear in mind. It's a crucial component of the modern economic system, but it's always overlooked. You're not going to learn about this at university. You're not going to hear about this on the BBC. You're not going to hear about this in the mainstream media. They don't want us to know what's really going on in the offshore economy. The offshore economy is there to serve the multinationals. It's the central component of the neoliberal agenda. They don't want you or I to understand what's happening. The main players, the big names in the financial world, the multinationals, the multiple retailers and the volume producers, the extraction industries, the governments that support the neoliberal agenda don't want us to know what's going on. Because if we did, we'd be unhappy about it. All right. Now, let me tell you what the Treasury here in the UK has been saying this year under George Osborne. They're announcing that the government wants to deliver a simpler tax system and ensure that corporation tax continues to place a relatively low compliance burden on businesses. Okay, that's quite an important point. New rules must minimise the impact on commercial decisions and not interfere with the efficient management of overseas operations. What the Treasury is trying to do there is create England as an offshore economy. London already is an offshore economy. The City of London is not part of the UK. It's a separate jurisdiction. The Queen cannot enter the Square Mile without permission from the Lord Mayor of London. That's true. Okay. It's shocking, but it's true. The City of London operates independently from the rest of this country. They have their own police force. They're not part of the Metropolitan Police, it's the City of London Police. They're a separate entity. And the City of London is the central component of the offshore economy. It's mainly run from England. It's mainly run from the city, Square Mile. If you are in any doubt about what they mean by the word efficiency when they talk about the tax system must allow efficient business use. Efficiency is an interesting word. Bob Diamond, who is the chief executive of Barclays Finance, his speciality is tax efficiency. Basically, that's another word for tax avoidance. They don't want to pay their tax, and they don't. Okay? Barclays Bank this year paid less than 3% tax. This year is interesting. On the 4th of January this year, you and I had a tax increase. VAT went up to a record level of 20%. Ordinary folk pay more VAT. In the budget, Mr. Osborne reduced corporation tax from 28% to 26%. But most big businesses, most of our high street names, don't pay that tax anyway. Mr. George Osborne, at Davos, the World Economic Forum this year, stated, "Our goal is the most competitive business tax regime of any major Western country." That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make England into a tax haven for the multinationals, for the big businesses. And neoliberalism is the motor of globalisation. So when we talk about the global economy, we're talking about the neoliberal agenda. Mr. Osborne, Mr. Cameron are neoliberals. They're not traditional politicians. They don't work for and on the behalf of their constituents. They work as the representatives of big business. That's their job. They're not politicians in the real sense. They are economists. Okay, so the developing countries who provide most of our goods, most of the high street goods, most of the stuff we buy in Marks and Spencer's or Topshop or Tesco, are produced in the global south. We now buy our trainers from Indonesia or from China or from Vietnam or from Thailand. We don't make stuff here anymore. We offshore labour. We find labour elsewhere, cheaper labour. The big businesses don't want to pay the rates here, so they look elsewhere to find labour to exploit. And then they use the offshore economy to make sure that they can keep all the profits of that. I'll finish up there because but this is a big thing. The offshore economy is the major thing, and that is what UK Uncut is trying to highlight in their high street campaign.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Okay, Jenny.
Okay, I'll just apologise for the garbled nature of what I'm about to say because I only had about 10 minutes warning that I was going to come and do this, and those are two really tricky acts to follow, so I'll give it my best shot. I was like just now asked, because the person who couldn't come and talk that was originally going to talk, to come and discuss the cuts and responses to the cuts from kind of a no borders perspective and from some recent struggles that have been happening, and I was kind of trying to sit and think about how to link it all up, but having then sat and listened to what John and Graham have said, it's just brought home yet again for me how fundamental the problems with borders and countries is to all of this, and how it's such an integral part of it that it doesn't need, you know, lots of examples to link it up. The issues with the global south and global north, and the division and economic problems between the two, and the massive exploitation of people in half the world, is all linked to this breaking up of people into countries that are based not on some kind of natural law that just appeared and has always been there, but have always been constructed for political reasons and political gain. And the modern example of that that's happening again is this construction of tax havens and people constructing whole political areas just so that money can be moved around more efficiently and to the gain of the people who hold the power strings in the first place. And what Becky was saying I wanted to talk about a little bit was the dangers in the UK during the sort of financial crisis that we are in, that people are going to be scapegoated from various communities, that it always happens. And in this country, the first on the list is often immigrants, because we have this wonderful situation where we have this global economy that's all interlinked, and money can go wherever it wants, and if it can't go there, they'll rewrite the laws so that it can go there. But people, poor people, who want to move for non-economic reasons and not bring thousands of pounds with them, there are massive barriers and borders in the way of their freedom of movement. And this is such a strange divide, that we have this global situation for money, but people are so restricted. And then when people do move to other countries for a million and one different reasons, if they've come to a country without money, and perhaps if they've come to a country because they're fleeing a problem in their own, they become victimised. Migrants coming into this country are from, you know, all different situations all over the world, and certainly when people talk about immigrants, they're not referring to the children of Russian oligarchs that live in London and bring money and bring business. And, you know, they're economic migrants the same as anyone else. But what you risk, I think, at the times of financial crisis is that immediately lack of jobs is going to be blamed on migrant workers. Benefits are going to be taken by, you know, immigrants that have come to this country to take our taxes, which then the implication is that we're all paying anyway, and as Graham has just pointed out, the corporations aren't paying them in the first place. And I think that it's fundamentally important, both from the point of view of a no borders struggle, to be highlighting these issues and destroying the absolute lies that they're based on, and also from the point of view of effectively combating the cuts, because whilst you're being distracted by their red herrings, and whilst people are believing what politicians want to put out there about the causes of all these things, then you're never going to be able to address the fundamental causes and where it's really coming from. And something that I'm just going to mention, because I've kind of spent my last month of my life there and I don't really know about anything else, is Dale Farm, that some of you might have heard of, the largest gypsy and traveller site in the UK, in Essex, is currently being evicted. And when it comes to linking struggles, I think this is really relevant right now, even from an economic and financial point of view. Even if you don't address the humanitarian issues that are here, it's very clear that this just shows up how little these economists, not politicians, have people's interests at heart, because they're spending in excess of £22 million to make about 500 people homeless, which is only going to cost more in the long run. And apparently somehow this is justifiable. This is money that has come from central government, and this is justifiable in times of financial crisis when we don't have money apparently to be spending on the NHS or spending on giving people homes that are already homeless. They will still use all this money to really attack a really, really vulnerable section of the population who still suffer so much prejudice. And that's only going to get worse. A lot of racial problems and attacks in the past and difficulties between communities have stemmed from it being twisted for economic gain, and without being dramatic, it is, and historically often has been, the gypsies have been the first people they've come for, and they will get rid of the gypsies with whatever means necessary if it suits them, to then twist the situation and somehow give this idea that we're all in it together and we should all be fighting for the same ends, which is nothing but Cameron and Osborne's cronies really not being able to pay any tax. But, and I'm just going to finish up saying that for me that links back to No Borders, like, really fundamental belief that the whole construction of countries and states and nation states in particular, this more modern phenomenon where you combine nation and a state, is really, really dangerous. And it's not that we believe that the world would be fine if there were no nation states but the economy would still run the same way. It is fundamentally anti-capitalist as well. And the real trick that nation states will play on you is making you believe that normal people in one country have got more in common with corporations in that country than they have with normal people in another one, just because it's been labelled something different. We'll stop there.
Okay, and our final speaker, just to finish off before we open it up, it's Chris.
Yeah, I just want to make 2 points. I'm not going to speak that long. I'm probably going to be quite negative, but I kind of think there's a need to be that negative given the kind of social and political problems that are facing us at this current time. The 2 points I want to make is one, and this one might sound a bit strange, but you'll have to kind of go with me, is capitalism in crisis? That seems to be a self-evident truth, which is puppeted both by right-wing and left-wing commentators. I kind of want to look at that a little bit more critically. And second, related to that analysis, have the responses so far been adequate, and what kind of response should we be building as people who are invested in the idea of a freer, better society? So is capitalism in crisis? Well, the first thing I want to say is that crisis is a very natural occurrence for a capitalist system. Crisis can be perfectly well incorporated into the very normal running of capitalism. In fact, the 1990s were rather unusual in that sense, that we didn't have, in the West at least, a major kind of crunch or recession. There's various kind of structural reasons to explain that, but just making the point that that's actually quite an unusual period of economic history when compared to how capitalism ran in the past. There's an Italian communist, Amedeo Bordiga, who has this fantastic phrase to describe capitalism, which he talks about it as the murder of the dead, that capitalism needs to continually destroy generations worth of work and production and labour in order to expand and build. That it's a fundamentally destructive process. It needs to eliminate all that's been grown in the past to continue growing in the future. So basically what I want to kind of argue is that, you know, crisis is not really that unusual. And what we could be seeing here is actually a restructuring of the way that global capitalism works. So what would a crisis in capitalism look like? Well, I kind of want to kind of lead on from kind of what people have been saying here, which is that capitalism is actually a social relationship. It is an economic system, but it's also about a minority of people owning the means of production, you know, the things that we can have to survive. And although at the moment profits are being affected in certain sections of the economy, there's absolutely no doubt that that minority still own the means of production. There are still powerful people who make us work every day, who force us to live in this society, and control that coercive power to do so through the state. And that really works, that really makes sense in terms of looking at this austerity agenda, because if there is no economic argument as to why austerity should happen, then where is it coming from? Well, it's coming from financial interests. It's coming from a capitalist class who want capitalism to develop in that way. So I guess I want to challenge this assumption that many people have on the left, that, you know, that we've entered a crisis, that capitalism is going to fall apart and we're going to enter this wonderful society, when actually what we really need to do is challenge the social relationships that still continue to reproduce the kind of world we live in. And that relates to the kind of current responses we have. I think it's worth bearing in mind that although things seem to have accelerated very quickly, and there's a sense that there's a lot more social unrest and civil disorder than there was maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, the position of the working class in this country was very weak before the crisis happened. You know, the neoliberal project led by Thatcher had pretty much destroyed working class organisation and sent to working class community. That was the state we were in before the crisis. And I don't think we should assume that we're in any different position now. And again, if we look at the initial responses that have come to the cuts, it's been the age-old solutions of trade unionism, compromise. You know, the trade unions are hoping that we can maybe negotiate a better way of cutting our wages, a better way of bringing austerity. There is no militancy because there's no willingness to kind of go in that direction. Many people felt that March 26th, the March Alternative, was kind of a show of strength. I actually think it was a massive sellout by the trade unions. You know, we knew the cuts were coming months before, and they postponed all action that could have happened directly on the ground to transport everyone down to London to then go and listen to Labour MPs talk about how they can present a better version of capitalism for us. We need to be aware of these realities. And I think the starkest thing, the starkest illustration of perhaps how weak we are as an anti-capitalist movement, as the left, if you want to use that label, is the riots. There was this real sense from both the trade unions and anti-capitalists when the riots happened that this was a section of the community which we had no contact with, we had no way of communicating with, that we couldn't even understand some of the ideas that were coming out. And that's a real problem. Primarily because, I mean, I personally think that the riots had potentially quite bad elements to them, anti-social elements, anti-class elements. And that's not to kind of demonise or ostracise people who were involved, but clearly there was a need for a political perspective, for a left anti-capitalist perspective within people who were fed up with their situation. And there was something that the Greek anarchist was saying in relation to the London riots, which is the solution to bad riots is better riots. you could definitely agree to say that. But it's true that if you look at December 2008 and you look at what happened this year in London, December 2008, where you had young people in hoods smashing up luxury shops, occupying universities, you know, that had such a beautiful potential to go further into like this freer, better society, because it was politicised. It had anti-capitalist ideas at its core. And I think this is the real challenge that faces us, and something which the left, unfortunately, and the trade unions, unfortunately, are completely failing to do. That there's just a complete lack of dialogue within wider communities as to why we should be opposed to the cuts, why the problem is capitalism, or why we need a better system. Okay, so that's all quite negative, but I want to finish up just my final point, which is something quite hopeful, which is that if you take my analysis that capitalism is not in crisis, these periods of economic restructuring do make capitalist social relations more stark and brutal. That when certain sections of the economy have to tighten their belts, the whole kind of nice boss, you know, social welfare version of what capitalism can be like quickly disappears. That capitalism in its rawest relationship returns, which is basically the boss trying to get as much out of you as he possibly can. And that opens a lot of eyes. And I think our job as anti-capitalists is to point, when people's eyes are open to this exploitative relationship, that we point them in the direction of an anti-capitalist future, of a better kind of society.
Initially, if we just have any questions to any of the people who've just spoken before we go on for other comments and discussion. Does anyone have any initial questions for anybody?
Can't see me because I'm right at the back. I feel like I'm wrestling when they used to walk in. yeah, I think I'm kind of echoing what Chris said, and then actually something me and Mark were talking about a minute ago. And I think it's this issue that as anti-capitalists is that we seem to have this gap between our activism and our real lives. It's like you were saying, what was the phrase you used? Yeah, you have your activism and then you go back to being a good consumer. You know, as if that it's not a thing that you should live. And I think it's something personally I discovered recently. Well, not really recently, but you know, a few months back was like I was always passionate about organising and unionising and everything like that. Then I realised for years I've been working in Pizza Hut and never thought to organise that. You know what I mean? And it's that kind of attitude that I think is a huge problem. You know, that we really need to smash that and really get rid of that. That, you know, everywhere you are you should be living anti-capitalism, you should be acting anti-capitalism, and it shouldn't be about the separation between I do this here and I do that there. And I mean, I guess my question is, do you think this is something that we need to discuss and we need to focus on breaking down that barrier between activism and life, you know, as if they're two separate entities? Yeah. Comment, question.
What I want to sort of suggest is that argue against Chris really, is that the capitalism is struggling. There's so many crises coming one after the other, and I suppose I've been focusing now on environmental crisis, the destruction of the environment, the planet, the species, the amount of carbon we've got, the rise in temperature and all that sort of stuff. But there is no business as usual, capitalism as usual way of dealing with that. With projections of the rise in temperatures and all that, there's going to be a huge die-off of human beings. There's going to be an absolute destruction of the environment and a massive extinction of species. Now, unless we, as activists, really take that up and really resist that, we're going to be in a lot of trouble.
Do you want to formulate that into a question at the end?
The question is, there are more crises. I think there are more crises. Are there any more?
Like a man can respond.
Should we just take one more and then maybe we'll get some responses?
I was just going to respond to him, actually, so acting
like yeah, do it.
Yeah, go for it,
then. I was going to argue against that because I don't know what makes you think that capitalists can't make a profit out of the world going to shit. I mean, they've already managed to trade in carbon futures. You've got value added to your bog roll when you buy the recycled rather than the version. Capitalism can make money out of anything. It's not going to save the world. The world's going to burn if things go on as they are, but the capitalists are going to be floating away in a very expensive spaceship.
Yeah. Okay, any other unusual questions? Yeah.
I don't think there appears to be a sort of culture of sort of pseudo-radicalism. Right? We do something for a day, go on a march for a day, we go on a strike for a day, and then just go home and have some tea and go to the pub. It seems like that there isn't the will to sustain a protest to any degree that causes revolution, like say in Egypt or arguably. Or Greece or New York, they're capable of sustained protest, but I don't think it. Well, I certainly haven't seen much evidence of it happening here.
Starting here today. Right.
Where does it end?
Do you want to say something about what's happening today?
I mean, I'm not hardly an expert, but they're occupying London today. And I think you mentioned Sheffield earlier.
Yeah, at 6 pm in front of City Hall.
Yeah.
Today?
Yes, today.
So I'll definitely be there.
Along with other cities throughout the world.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, 1,500 different cities, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just something about the riots that was mentioned. I think my question is, It was definitely a political movement, but it was anti-austerity, maybe, not anti-capitalist. So yeah. How do we give weight to these amazing, young, courageous people who have basically come like closest to a revolution that I've seen in a very long time? How do we get on their side? How do they get on our side? And how do we give them weight and not just call them antisocial and non-apolitical?
Okay, I'll just take one at the back and then I'll get the speakers to come in. Who had their hand up at the back?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I guess, kind of linking in with the point about how do we sustain protests rather than it just being like, let's go out for a day kind of march. I guess also, like, how do you think we can... when we're suggesting to people there is an alternative to capitalism and there is an alternative to like hierarchical like landlord boss relationships, things like that, how do we ensure that we don't just end up creating new hierarchies all over again? Because I think sometimes some people find a lot of comfort in their kind of like, oh, someone else is taking all the responsibility kind of relationship. So yeah, I guess that's my question, really.
Okay. Do you want to come back with anything?
Just on whether we've got a global crisis or not, I'd have thought by now it's pretty clear we do have. But I think that Chris is absolutely right to make the point that capitalism is always in a state of crisis. So, but really, I what somebody else was, what Ronin and others have sort of suggested as well, is that there is a real sense, I think, that this is a time of culmination. This is like the Bank of England, the head of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, just said this crisis is going to be worse than the Great Depression, right? And that's what he says in public,
yeah.
Right? This is the greatest crisis that capitalism has ever faced. Right now, we've got an astonishing, just what's happening in Europe, leave aside the United States. Right now, just what's happening in Europe, you've got a simultaneous sovereign debt crisis and banking crisis, and they're mutually reinforcing. The banks need huge amounts of money. We're going to be hearing about this a lot in the next few months. Huge amounts of taxpayers' money here in RBS and others to try and recapitalise the banks because of new massive debts losses they're going to be making, even if they only manage to stop the default happening with Greece and it doesn't spread to other countries. And so, but the problem is that the banks have lent so much money to governments, and the governments are the have to go and put money into the banks. How do the governments get money to put into the banks? Well, they have to borrow the money from the banks, right? So you've got this incredible sort of deathly embrace, and so you've got the top economist of the Financial Times, Martin Wolf, and others coming up with a different way. Instead of borrowing the money to pay for social spending and to recapitalise the banks and to pay for schools and hospitals, he suggests we turn on the printing presses. And not just turn them on for an hour or two, turn them on and keep them running. That's what he's saying. Right? And he's in line for a Nobel Prize for economics, apparently. That's the sort of extreme... No, but I mean, he's right in a sense, because the only way that they can replace collapsing demand and avert a global depression and a slump and a return to economic trade wars, currency wars and shooting wars... is by doing what he says, but of course he's wrong, because that is just another road into the crisis, as I've said. So I just think, you know, we certainly have a mother of all crises happening, and I don't think there is a capitalist solution. There's a Cuban revolutionary economist who wrote a book recently called Capitalism and Crisis, Sin Salida, Without a Way Out. And he said that what this crisis shows is that it's necessary for humanity to begin the transition to a communist mode of production. And that is what this crisis poses. He said that in 1916, Rosa Luxemburg said socialism or barbarism, but now we have to say it's socialism or nothing. That's what he said. What do you mean by socialism? I know there's different points of view, but a way of socially collective, etc. Either we make that big transition or there is no future for humanity. And that is going to be decided in the next couple of years, this is the culmination. I just think that that is where I disagree a little bit with Chris.
We were asked, how do we carry on living as activists, and is there a division between our activism and our daily life? I think that's a hard question. I try and live in a way that is anti-corporate. And I try and explain to everybody I meet, my colleagues, my clients in the work environment, my friends and relationships out in the world. What's going on? It's very, very difficult, and I very often come home depressed after a day at work or an evening with friends because so few people actually do understand what's going on there. I think that's partly to do with the world that we live in today, the media that is constantly giving the corporate message. Advertising is more sophisticated now than ever. Few folks out there really do understand. We gather here together, and I'm sure most of you feel the same as I do, that there's something very, very wrong in the way that we're structuring and organising our world. But most folk out there are still shopping. They're still on the high street. How do we reach them? I think UK Uncut have spent many an afternoon on Fargate. A number of folks here I recognise from other campaigns in other towns as well. But the message is still not getting across, and how we get that message across to ordinary folk is the big question. The left seems to be in disarray. As Chris points out, the unions haven't really got a real core message to deliver to their membership. New Labour aren't really interested in challenging the cuts. They're just saying, well, they just don't need to be quite as deep or quite as quick. And they're not really giving us a real basis to fight the corporate interests. What do we do? How do we get that message across? That's the big question for all of us, I think. So it might be worth more debate on that point.
I think I was really interested in people talking about that division between activism and normal life. It's something that, yeah, I feel quite strongly about trying to link it up, and I'm not sure what the answer is, because I think that we talk about not wanting to just go on a demo and then go back to normal life and being a consumer, and that makes sense. But unfortunately, if you make this big effort to remove yourself completely from the whole capitalist world you really disagree with, what you end up is having no route to actually connect to other people and talk to them. And I think that's the tension, that yes, you want to try and live your whole life as in line with your beliefs as you can, but to cut yourself off from normal people because they don't understand anyway is just never going to get this message across to anyone else and never going to make a difference there. So I think there is quite a strong argument for not losing all touch with normal life either, when it means you can maybe reach the normal people.
Yeah, I'll make this very brief. In terms of the writers, I wouldn't say that they were not political. I think they were very politically motivated. I suppose in those kind of, like, I don't expect riots to be perfect sort of things. I think they're messy and horrible, and lots of people get hurt accidentally, and you know, inevitably they will be to a degree antisocial, even to our social values. But I don't know, sort of in periods of insurrection, I think sort of working people tend to figure out for themselves, out of the necessity of organising, how to sort of see a better society. I suppose the problem was the riots weren't that protracted, so lots of people kind of went out, discovered that they were able to sort of push kind of the security forces to their limits, push kind of bourgeois values to their limits, but then there was no kind of going further. And I suppose that's kind of where we come in a way, that we kind of point out the power of what they're doing, that they're showing that you can just go out and take what you need. But everyone needs to do that, you know, and we need to kind of extend those kind of actions into something more meaningful. In terms of hierarchy, I think the struggle against hierarchy is probably a permanent thing that we have to accept always happens, but I mean, I take great comfort in being part of a tradition of social anarchism that has answered a lot of questions to do with that, and I kind of affiliate and attach myself to that tradition, and I think it provides a lot of answers to those questions. The whole kind of capitalism in terminal crisis, I'm just really wary of making those kind of judgments, because I remember reading the stuff from the 1970s and all these economists going like, oh, it's going to be fine, we'll have a communist society by 1979, and it just looked really embarrassing in the future. But I will say that I'm unsure of these issues, but I think there is quite a compelling argument that what we're potentially witnessing is a transference of economic power from West to East, that potentially China could be a real winner out of this crisis, and we might have a new global economic power. How critical that is, I'm not sure.
I think it's only a matter of time before China becomes the world economic power. I think it may well already have by the time we're able to tell anyone.
Yeah.
And the last thing on activism and daily life, I suppose, sort of neoliberalism has kind of won in the sense that it's depoliticized our societies. I think that's something we probably have to accept. That's just a general point. But I suppose, like, at least, although I think there are many problems with this kind of occupation movement and the kind of lack of the content of the ideas, at least it seems to be pushing the idea that politics is something you can encounter and do as part of, you know, your daily life, rather than just politics being a representative thing that's just about kind of standing with a placard and hoping someone listens to you. So potentially that's, you know, we need to move to kind of an area where politics is a meaningful thing that we do, that we actually taking power, like make change in things. And I think that that stops that kind of division being a problem.
Right. Okay, so more questions or comments, contributions, anybody? Yeah.
Okay, just a question and a comment. Basically, question, how would you build an alternative economy that's self-sustaining? And the comment is, I've got an idea for microactivism that I should use sometimes. Basically, if you know someone who banks with a really, really filthy corporate bank, you can tell them about it, suggest alternatives, and encourage them to switch to another bank or to a building society. That's the comment.
So I was just going to reply to that. Yeah, I think it's interesting that you mentioned, like, when we're suggesting alternatives to, like, I don't know, banking with conventionally bad banks.
Yeah.
Is it really, is it really an alternative to banking with another bank, or is that just continuing this relationship of putting money, giving money to the more powerful when the less, you know, and, you know, yeah, more profit to people who can then invest in more bad things. And I know you've got like the cooperative bank who have these ethical lending policies and are meant to be a lot better. But I mean, what I guess I'd be interested to know, like, what people think. Do people think that is a long-term sustainable solution to just bank with more ethical banks, or do we need another way of you know, keeping our resources safe, so to speak, and sort of organising our economy, basically.
Okay, and then next to one.
Well,
and then
I was actually just going to say on that exact topic. That's why I credit you. I mean, that's personally, I think, as anti-capitalists, we should all pull our money out of banks altogether and move towards using credit unions. Because credit unions are democratically organised, they're based, I mean, obviously it's still a form of banking, but it's a much more acceptable form of banking, I think, you know. Personally, that's what I would say. I mean, I still use co-op, but I think that, because there is still difficulties with, like, credit unions and stuff, and they can be quite small, but I mean, if there was a movement for people to move into credit unions, that'd be a very positive thing. I think that would show people that there is a lack of faith in the banking industry.
Was going to say this. Follows up neatly. How do you convince people that you don't actually need money to stay alive? I can't eat stuff.
I think it's probably a good idea to get rid of all the banks and get those credit unions, but I've been in the UK now since September and I haven't had a debit credit or anything like that. And I find it really hard to do anything. For instance, my landlord, he asked for a debit credit. If I want to have a phone, he asked for a debit credit. Even if I were to join... I was asked to join Counterfire. He asked for debit cards. So it's really hard not to have an English account or any another bank account and to join society, which is very important to still be part of society.
So I think it would be really good, but it needs to grow.
Credit unions have like banking, where you set up, you essentially do set out a bank account. You don't get the plastic card, but it's the account numbers and stuff like that. So you'd still be able to do stuff like that online. Okay. I'm not selling credit unions. It's not like I have. You are one.
Can I just say there's some seats available if people who are standing at the back want to come and sit down, and then yes.
Okay, so, I'm a bit wary of this talk between activism in real life and activists and normal people. So I think that's not the best dichotomy to get into. So I kind of like to think that you can be both. where do you go? It just creates a separation between there's this kind of vanguard of activists and the rest of the normal people. I think that's a dangerous way to look at it. I mean, I think you need to sort of think about that and not use the term. So this is quite a lot of terms, which should actually be an act as well.
For instance, like, would you say, yeah, like, I really agree, and I know it was me that just used that.
Yeah, it wasn't a...
No, I know, it was kind of a shorthand for saying, I think you just expressed really well kind of what I was trying to say about agreeing the two. I was going to say something else about that, but I just forgot, so I probably
remember.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't respond to the very many interesting points being made about activism and how to live meaningful lives and all this stuff. You know, very important questions. Well, it just seems to me that we're going to be going through an extraordinary experience. I think it's an astonishing privilege and an amazing thing to be alive at this particular moment, to be able to live through the next few decades. And I think we should just see ourselves as, we are part of the people, not something separate from it. Anybody gets into mentality, I don't feel myself as part of the left. I just see that revolution is the middle way. It's not left or right, it's not extreme. It's just the only responsible way to behave is to actually overthrow this destructive system and create something better before there's no world left to do this. And we go through this experience with the people, with the working class. Everybody who doesn't rely on the labour of others, for me, is a member of the working class. We go through this experience with our class and learn from them and learn with them. And you can see that this is the crisis that's coming in Greece in the last 18 months, according to the Guardian report yesterday, a few days back. Average household income has declined by 50%. 50% in Greece. What? And they haven't even defaulted yet. They haven't yet been kicked out of the EC. This is, of the European Union. They've yet to reach the end of the cliff. 50%. In Greece, the distinction between ordinary life and the struggle is rapidly diminishing, and so it will do here, right? Mm. And we just need to be part of that, and also have always at all times a completely internationalist perspective. I think that's the absolute key thing, is that we have to give solidarity to the most oppressed and most exploited amongst us, and that is why the question of asylum seekers and migrant workers is absolutely central to politics. You can see it in the United States, you can see it here. It is on this issue that the fascist movement will come back. In 1927, the Nazi Party got 2.7% of the vote. 1933, just 6 years later, they got 37% of the vote. We've already got fascist parties receiving far more than 2%, 2.7% of the vote in many European countries. Where are we going to be in 6 years' time? Right? And so the struggle to defend the most oppressed and exploited...